The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
Folks, welcome back to Straight Talk Money. I'm your host, Chase Robertson, Peggy Tuck. Hope you're having a wonderful Monday morning. We are fortunate enough to have one of my favorite guests on, Jack Ablin. In fact, the funny thing about Jack is I've actually never met him, but I see him on CNBC all the time, and I'll walk around the office and go, hey, look, there's Jack Ablin. So hopefully one day I get a chance to meet him. But beyond that, I just find myself funny when I do it. Jack is the Chief Investment Officer, and he was previously the Chief Investment Officer for BMO Harris Bank. He's been on the show
many times. He's also a rock star at the money shows. If anybody's ever been to a money show, his room is packed all the time. But he moved over to Crescent back in 2018.
Anyway, welcome back to the show, sir.
Thank you. Happy New Year. And by the way, look for me on Squawk Box tomorrow morning.
Yay!
That's part of the reason I'm going to New York this afternoon.
There you go, a real celebrity. Anyway, Jack, I think the most pressing question for you from our listeners would be, really what to be concerned about is they hear so much from geopolitical risk, interest rate risk, timing of retirement. What is the biggest concern you see in the market from all of the talking heads?
I would say it's this relationship that equity investors have with the Fed, that the under the Powell regime, if you will, the Fed neither has the markets backed because they want to bail out the equity market, or it's just simply they don't have the wherewithal to bail out the equity market in the event things go awry. So I think part of the reason why I believe during that December press conference that Chairman Powell had with the markets, everyone got so upset was because he more or less laid down the law and said, "Look, we don't have we don't have your back anymore, and we're going to continue to operate to manage the economy and not worry about bailing out equity investors." So I think if you go back in history, you'll find that Greenspan did it, Bernanke did it, Yellen did it, and Powell probably would like to do it, but with a $4.5 trillion balance sheet and interest rates that are still probably below fair value in the front end, certainly, and about a point and a half below fair value in the intermediate term, there really isn't much the Fed can do besides arm flapping to get the stock market off of its back if it ends up there.
Jack, everyone always says the economy is one thing, the market and its performance is another thing. Do you think that the Fed now is having much more of an impact on that and bringing them together?
I think so. I mean, the way it was described to me years ago, and it really makes a lot of sense. If you think about it, it's sort of like the economy is the dog owner walking the dog, and the market is the dog without a leash. And over short periods of span, the dog's going to go wherever it's going to go, but eventually it's going to follow its owner back to wherever it needs to go. So I do think that the equity market isn't tethered to the economy, but it has to, over long periods of time, has to track it. And that's why you see, for example, the market take a dive before a recession and the market kind of rallying back before a recovery. So it is tied to the business cycle, and right now, I'm not sure what the market's seeing. I don't, you've got a correction territory in the equity market. You've got what looks like could be an inverted yield curve soon. We don't see a recession on the horizon, but there is a little bit of a disconnect right now.
An inverted yield curve, though, does it, that notes a potential recession historically, correct?
It has. And this is where I don't like to say this time is different, but I do think this time is different. When you've got when you've got central banks loading up on intermediate term bonds to the tune of $14.5 trillion, and yes, the Fed is starting to let its balance sheet wind down, but it wasn't until last month that the European Central Bank was continuing buying intermediate term bonds at a rate of about $70 billion a month. And even then, they're going to reinvest any coupon and maturity payment that they get. The Bank of Japan is still in quantitative easing mode. The Bank of Switzerland is still in full quantitative easing mode. So there's still this artificial demand for intermediate-term bonds. You know, keep in mind, $7.5 trillion worth of bonds, even today, are sporting yields of less than zero. So that suggests that there's some manipulation still going on. And so if I'm looking at a 10-year that's largely influenced by the rest of the world, you know, I think the 2-year is probably fair value. I just don't think the 10-year is fair value. So the yield curve inversion isn't telling me the same thing that it normally would.
While we're on the topic of cost of capital, you know, obviously companies, portfolio companies, operating companies have had, you know, a good decade of cheap money available to them, almost free, less inflation. What number do you see, you know, in the mortgage market, I'll just use that as an example, that you think is the ceiling that really puts a halt on growth domestically?
That's a fantastic question. We saw mortgage rates rise above 5%, and then kind of the housing market hit a standstill. It was almost a brick wall. Mm-hmm. And I think you make a very interesting point that, you know, while I can sit here and say that, you know, the 10-year Treasury, you know, and I think even Jamie Dimon has picked up on this too, that the 10-year Treasury should be 4 or 4.5%, just because that's where nominal GDP is. You know, you get a 10-year Treasury at 4%. I mean, that's gonna push the conventional mortgage rate into the, you know, well into the fives, and you know, that's kind of a self-defeating situation by itself. So it is really interesting. I do think probably fair value, while I think theoretically is 4 to 4.5%, I think the 10-year Treasury probably can't get to much more than 3.75 to 4 before we see, you know, mortgage rates at 5.5, and then that really puts a damper, kind of throws a wet blanket over the housing market.
Yeah, I agree. I think 5 is the number I have in my head for a real slowdown in that space, just from a psychological standpoint.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the fact is that, you know, one of the first money management roles I had was a mortgage-backed securities trader, and I know that it's not just the rate of mortgage, it's the path at which we got to that mortgage rate. And so because we've had rates so low, you know, ordinarily a 5%, you know, if we're talking about a 5 or 5.5% mortgage rate and rates have historically been at 6, you know, well, happy days are here again. But if rates have been in the 3s, a 5.5% mortgage is pretty damning.
All right, folks, we'll be right back after this important break with the opening bells. You're listening to Straight Talk Money.
The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
We are talking with Jack Ablin, who is the Chief Investment Officer for Crescent Asset Management. Jack's a good friend of the show's. He's one of my favorite people to see on TV, and he will be on TV tomorrow.
On
Squawk Box. So look out for him. He's the good-looking guy with the good statements. So anyway,
Jack, of course, talking about what kind of effect that the Fed has and everything, what are you seeing Jeremy Siegel came out last week and he said if we can avoid a recession, then he sees a rally after maybe these first few months. And, of course, if a recession comes into play, he said all bets are off and we'll just see things go lower. What do you see looking ahead in your crystal ball?
Sure. I try to equate current to history. I'm a math guy. And so, one of the things that I see out there is a parallel to, in many respects, the tech bubble. Let me just elaborate on that. If you remember Greenspan's Fed back in the late 90s, early 2000s, he flapped his arms and uttered the irrational exuberance remarks in 1996, but he didn't raise rates. And the reason he didn't raise rates, he was trying to talk the market down, was because he was reading Ed Yardeni's End of the World tomes on Y2K. You know, there was a fear that as the computers rolled into 2000, that we wouldn't be able to turn the lights on once we went into the new millennium. So I think Greenspan, fearful that that was a possibility, I don't know if he actually fully subscribed to that notion, kept interest rates artificially low. He kept bank liquidity remarkably high because he thought, you know, if the Fed wire system didn't work, we needed liquidity around. And so he pumped a lot of liquidity into the system, even after, you know, between 1996, when he thought the market was expensive, all the way through the beginning of 2000. And then what happened, 2000 hits, he woke up, he turned on the lights, and lo and behold, started raising interest rates. So they were behind the curve and started ratcheting up rates. And then, of course, the high-flying growth stocks, which had been, you know, the FANG stocks of yesteryear, were the highest flyers and then the sharpest fallers. But here's the point I want to make, and this was something that Chase was just talking about. Value investing. Well, by March of 2000, there was a watershed event that occurred in value investing, and that was when Julian Robertson, who had run this massive Tiger Fund that was a deep value investment firm, decided he had enough. He closed his doors, and that was the bottom for value investing. And as it turned out, value really outperformed growth for a period of, I think, between 5 and 7 years after that. And, you know, if you look at the persistency, for example, of momentum investing over the last 5 years, momentum investing has been up 12.1% per year, value investing up 6.9%. So not quite double, but pretty darn close. So far this year, value investing up 2.6, momentum investing down 0.2. So perhaps we're starting to see that rotation into value investing after this five-year period where, you know, I argue that interest rates have been held artificially low.
Absolutely. I mean, and then remember, folks, Jack makes a good point, and he's talking about the rotation that we always discuss. And for you who are clients of ours, that's Charles Sizemore's portfolio, Mike Robertson's old dividend growth portfolio. But never forget, at a certain point in this year, removing stocks that trade at unusually high multiples, people will sell, or if there are some issues this year that don't get ironed out, geopolitical issues, they will sell stocks that are trading at 28 to 30 times, and they will go buy stocks that are trading at 8 to 10 or 12 times price to earnings. If you look at those 8 to 10 times now, you can find phenomenal yields. Phenomenal yields. 5 to 10% yields on your money. In some cases, you couldn't get, the only other place you could get it is an illiquid asset. And you would have to be buying at a much higher number to get into a trade like that. So continue to take a look at value, and Jack makes a good point. We're seeing institutional buyers cycle into those value or stocks that are on sale. Everybody likes buying things on sale. So he makes a good point that backs up some of our ideas.
Jack, are there sectors, do you look at sectors specifically that when looking ahead at investment opportunities, and are there sectors that you like for 2019?
I haven't done that work yet. I was done about a month ago, and so I have to. In fact, that's what I'm working on this morning. Mm-hmm. I will say, larger term, we do like international over U.S. If you argue that perhaps the Fed will tap on the brake a little bit, or at least take their foot off the accelerator. And then, meanwhile, remember, Mario Draghi's, this is his last year, and generally central bankers like to tie up loose ends. And right now, loose ends are that aggressive policy he's had. So it's possible we could see dollar weaken incrementally this year. International investing, which, of course, is better value than U.S., could lead the way higher. I do think we're going to have a positive year this year. But I think international and potentially emerging markets leading that incremental bull market higher.
And you mentioned the word cycle earlier, and we talk about this quite often, because is the market just doing what it's supposed to be doing? It's going through its cycle. I mean, it was going up, 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 and then obviously it at some point it was going to have to pull back.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if you think about where we were, there are a number of things that sort of converged last year. We had what I'll call the double espresso shot of monetary policy, aggressive monetary policy, plus the corporate tax bill that really boosted fiscal. And at the same time, expectations in terms of investor bullishness was at a near all-time high. And so it was remarkable. Remember the first few days, maybe a couple, 10 days of 2018, kept just rising for no reason. And I think it was just this enthusiasm. Eventually, that espresso shot wore off, and so did the bullishness. And now it's almost the opposite. We started this year with investor attitudes near an all-time low, and looking at kind of slowing growth. So I think that we tend to overshoot on both sides, and I think that that's part of it as well. So the cycle is probably not as exaggerated as emotions are, mm-hmm. but emotions are pretty low right now.
All right, folks, we're bumping up, gets a break. Chase Robertson, Peggy Tuck, Jack Ablin. We'll be right back after these important announcements.
The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
If you've been listening or just joining us for the final segment, we've had the pleasure of interviewing a good friend of the show's, Jack Ablin, who is the chief investment officer, for Crescent Asset Management. Really, relatively new firm to the street. I think it's only a couple years old, but growing at a rapid pace. that's right, isn't it? The Crescent's relatively new, correct?
But, yeah, we're one year old, and we're nearly $4 billion already.
Wow!
They've surpassed us already. So,
well, we've been. I mean, look, individually, we all been in this business for a long time.
Anyway, and I've been noting he will be on Squawk Box tomorrow. So, if you want to see him in person, tune in.
I'd also like to interject, because Jack has a book, and you may have more than one book by now, but your book, he's the author of Reading Minds and Markets, Minimizing Risk and Maximizing Returns in a Volatile Global Marketplace. Now, while this was published in 2009, boy, it really holds true today, too, as well.
Thank you. Yeah, it was the Wall Street Journal bestseller when it first came out, so encouraged by that.
Well, fantastic. And, of course, we're talking about the markets. Jack, do you think that the bottom's in, or that we're getting close to it?
I think so. I think one of the things, you know, we alluded to it earlier was, are we as investors now, you know, dancing around on a tightrope without a net, just because we don't have the central banks anymore? And really what that means is, you know, if we really do get into trouble here, you know, do the central banks have the wherewithal to get us out? So I think there is some concern that perhaps, you know, if as you're doing your scenario analysis, some investment strategists are probably putting in a worse worst-case scenario, you know, kind of a downside risk that's a little lower because we don't have the Fed wherewithal. But, you know, if you ascribe a percentage to it, it's pretty low. So, we probably do have a heightened risk environment. But I think our best case or most likely case scenario is still, you know, incrementally positive gains this year.
Yeah, I mean, and that, you know, folks, that ties into some themes that we, you know, talk about on the show is that, you know, own quality. Understand why you own a stock. You know, if the stock does nothing this year, will you have a gain on dividend? You know, on January 3rd last year, you know, I think one of the more key things that we noted on the show was that you're most likely your dividends are going to be your only gains for the year. That really came true. So, you know, focus on portfolio allocation. You know, during the break, Jack was noting some of the things that Crescent was underweight and overweight. You know, if you have a position, I always say you have 200 shares of a stock and the stock's doubled over the last 5 years, take 100 shares off the table, reallocate. Make sure you're keeping each position in that 3.5% to 5.5% of your total portfolio if you're running an equity strategy. So there's some of those small professional trading or portfolio management techniques you can implement that can keep you from having, you know, pullbacks that are in line with the market or running a portfolio that has a beta or volatility that's equal to one or what the market does each and every day. Remember, we always focus here at Roberts Wealth Management on keeping your beta below 0.8 through a variety of securities. So if you're doing that on your own, something to think about. Beyond all the things that we've noted today, which I think we've touched on mainly the high level issues that I think investors are concerned about.
And Jack, because you are a math person and a historian, so to speak, when it comes to the markets, all right. So we may have missed out on a little bit of the Santa rally this year, but do the markets generally historically start out a little rocky on a new year before it maybe gets its footing under him?
Well, actually, historically, January's been a pretty good month just because a lot of, bonuses are being paid or tax refunds are coming back. And so money tends to filter into the market in January, first, probably second half of January in particular. So I think that historically there has been this, you know, we'll call it January effect. Before that, it was always small cap stocks outperforming. Now I don't know if that's as persistent. But I think there is something to that sell in May and go away. That May through October period is pretty lousy, at least since the 1950s. Certainly, way outperformed by the November to through April. So there is something to that, and we're in now that positive six-month period.
And we've got earnings coming up. And, of course, that'll be fourth-quarter earnings, but we'll be starting to hear from companies, I believe it's next week, that we start getting earnings coming in. What do you anticipate seeing there? Do you think we're seeing finally the full effect of the tax cuts?
I think we're going to. I actually think if you take a lot of the pieces and put it together, you know, what has the market really fallen on? There's nothing really tangible. The market is falling on headlines, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe you could argue the Apple announcement, yes, but that's just one little piece of it, and it seemed like that was reversed the next day. But if you look at the bigger move, most of it is really just conjecture on some of these headlines, right? And what the market really needs is something tangible, something that they can really sink their teeth into fundamentally, and that's earnings. And earnings has been pretty strong. So I actually view, the earnings news that comes out in the Q4 earnings that comes out, like you said, in a week or two, to be a real bullish signal for the market. When people start, you know, getting hit over the head with what's really important, and that's earnings, we're going to find that I think they're pretty solid. Now, that said, if management takes the opportunity to, you know, sing a tale of woe, about, you know, the global markets and everything else, that, you know, that's a different matter in their outlooks. But I do think Q4 earnings will be pretty solid.
Oh, that's good. But of course, last year what we saw were a lot of companies coming in with strong earnings, and yet their stock kind of got beat up.
Well, remember, no good earnings go unnoticed. It's historically, if you beat earnings and there are no catalysts or there are no drivers to bring you down, like falling commodity prices, your stock is up over the next 6 months. So in my opinion, I think earnings could keep this going. If we continue to see strong earnings across the board, especially in the lead players in each sector, you know, this thing slowly, it's not double digit, but strong single digit returns plus a dividend, you can get to double digit returns, you know, into 2020 without a problem. But I still think it's a stock picker's, this is a stock picker's year, period, to beat the major indices. You're just going to have the right set. So we have our 10. We'll see how we do. So anyway, Jack, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Folks,
this
Jack Ablin, Chief Investment Officer of Crescent Asset Management. Feel free to reach out to Peggy. We have some of his more recent articles and investor letters if you'd like more information.
Especially, yes, if you missed the name of the book, send me an email at straighttalkmoney.com. I'll be glad to get it to you.
Anyway, folks, thanks for listening. We've been having a great day. Straight Talk Money. We'll be back tomorrow at the regular time. And it's Mike Robertson would say, God bless. Go out and make yourself a little bit of money.
You have been listening to a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.